Hello, and welcome back to Heard and Not Seen, a podcast from Barnardo's. For the Oral History Project today, we've again brought together two people from two different generations, again to discuss their unique shared experience of being women of colour and spending time in care. Like Maureen, who you heard in the last episode, Julianne also grew up in the Barnardo's Girls Village in East London. Julianne is in conversation with Irene, a young woman who also spent time in care. You met Irene in the last episode. She was the young woman talking to Maureen. Among the many things they talk about, they share their thoughts on the term mixed race. Julianne explains why she always supports the Indians in cowboy and Indian films. And she reveals how she tracked down her father, who just happened to be living on the very same road as her best friend. The purpose of this type of conversation is to give two people, one older and one younger, the chance to compare and contrast the shared life experience. They get to swap some of the wisdom and knowledge they've gained on their respective journeys, and we get to learn something too.
Hi Irene, my name's Julianne.
Nice to meet you. So when and where were you born?
I was born in Hackney, London, Hackney Hospital. Nice. In 1960.
How long did you spend in care, and where were you in care?
Right, well, I was in a place called The Village, Dr. Barnardo's, which was an original institution set up by Dr. Barnardo's. It used to be all girls and then it sort of turned into all boys. So when I was there, it was a very strange place to be. So as a village of children, so it was full when I was there, with three separate sort of greens, and each house had a family of 15 and two sort of house mothers. And I arrived when I was a baby.
Okay.
And I lived in care until I was 18, and in the Barnardo's village for 16 of those 18 years.
Wow.
So all my life in the sort of children's village.
Yeah, and you said it was all girls at first.
Yeah, it was initially all girls.
In the 20th century,
not now.
Yeah, so, no, I was just interested.
Why it was set up like that? Well, it was, it was very strictly divided, the men and the girls and the boys.
Oh, I see.
Back in the day. When I arrived there, it was mixed.
And you spent your whole life there?
I did spend my whole life there, which is kind of weird. Wow. But there you
are. Yeah. Why did you come into care, and what was your family background like?
Well, my mother and father were very young. I think my mother was 19, my father's 20 or something, or 21. And they had a sort of love affair, I suppose you could call it. And my sister and I were put into care as babies because they never married. And quite soon after, my father married a West Indian woman. So I think in those days, the black people marrying white people was a sort of weird thing that nobody did, or
yeah.
a few people did, but it was difficult for them to navigate their way around, and they, you know, the relationship wasn't really taken seriously by anybody particularly. So my mother put us into care as babies. My sister and I have a sister.
Yeah, you were in care together. Did you stay all throughout your time together?
Well, again, in the old days, the siblings weren't really recognised. Everybody was more or less separated.
Really?
And so we were separate. My sister and I were separated until we were about four or something. Wow. And also, it was also not entirely possible to have two babies in the house. Sometimes babies were separated just because there wasn't enough support, you know.
You said you were separated until you were 4 years old. Were you aware that your sister was in care also?
No, not really, not particularly, I must say. It was all, I had another sort of, the thing about Barnardo's is that we had other siblings, so the people in our cottage, and we made other friends. So I had another sister who identified as a sister. And we were sort of thrown together because we were the two babies in the household. And my sister was another baby in another household. So we were very kind of ignorant of each other, really, until my mother occasionally visited. And then we were sort of thrown together in a pushchair type thing, which was very strange.
Yeah.
But that was kind of, I don't know how normal that was. It was just, that's just how it was, I suppose, in those days.
Do you remember what it was like reconnecting with her? I can't imagine. It must have been very odd.
Well, it wasn't really, because we, as I say, we were all each other's brothers and sisters.
Okay.
And the kind of, and there were so many of us. I mean, those days, I mean, maybe, I don't know how many, hundreds of children. And so you have to imagine it is really a village. So it was kind of irrelevant in a sense that we had, actual biological siblings. So it was just normal, because that's kind of what we knew until we discovered that it was really weird when we grew up.
How would you describe your own cultural identity?
Right. Well, I don't like the term mixed race at all. Okay. Do you use that term?
Yeah, that's what I tend to use.
Yeah.
How come you don't like it?
Well, just recently, I've got a lot of friends who are, mixed dual heritage. And, it's half Spanish, half German, half Greek, half German, and they never use that term. And I realized that it was used just for black and white people. Mm. And I kind of wanted to get away from describing myself as black and white. I just wanted to be dual heritage. So I'm English and I'm English and West Indian. That's my heritage. So I prefer, not to sort of introduce myself as the half black bit.
Yeah.
So the dual heritage, I think it's a fantastic term for everybody who's got half and half of heritage parents, and not always just to refer to our skin colour.
Yeah.
Because as I say, my friends who are half one or the other half European, half something, they don't use that term at all. They just say their parents are heritage, which is what we should be doing. Because then we don't even know. I don't know that you're half African, or you don't know that I'm half West Indian. It's just, half black, half white. That's it. That's the end of the conversation, and that's not right, you see. It's much more interesting than that.
It does all get lumped into one category, like black is very...
Black is black. Yeah.
Yeah.
And my family would be very different from your family.
No, definitely.
Totally different culture, so it doesn't make sense to say mixed race.
I also find I used to shy away from saying I was black because I was only half black, but then I think it was important for me to kind of be like, no, I am black. I do still, so I think now, as well as mixed race, I will say that I'm black.
Yes, that's the other difficulty, because people see, it's like we see ourselves as half and half, but other people just see the black bit. That's the only thing that they see. So if I say, well, I'm English, they all kind of say, well, how come you're English? They want to know. And of course, you can explain it. But the easiest, in a way, we're put on the spot, and the easiest thing to do is just to kind of do the shorthand and say, we're black, and then everybody shuts up then. But that's not good either.
No.
And it's the black part of you that is more obvious, I suppose, than the white part. And the same for me. And the same for me. So then it's just convenient for other people.
No, I agree. But I also think it is helpful to be able to embrace that, because I think that's why I think I shied away from it, is that there was so much negativity. Not even that, I just wanted to be like a bit more accepted, so I wouldn't be like, oh, I'm black. I'd be like, I'm half white.
Yes, well, half, yes. It's as I say, we're trying to fit in for the convenience of everyone else.
Yeah.
And actually, we should be putting them on the spot and kind of, could you just kind of have a bit more interest and convenience us. So where's your mother from, for example? No, I don't know.
Yeah. Oh, was so, that actually a question?
Where is she from?
She's from Kenya. She was born in Kenya.
Oh, your mother's born in Kenya.
Yeah. Oh, nice. Yeah, same as me.
I automatically assume that your father's from Kenya. It's terrible how this works. I mean, we're always sort of wrapped up in this stereotype thinking. Because in my reference, it's always the African who comes to Britain or Europe, to go to university, falls in love with, European. Mm. And here you are the other way around.
Mm. When did you first become aware of race?
Well, I was thinking about that question, and it's kind of interesting, because we used to watch cowboy and Indian films, cowboy and Indian films back in the 60s. And, a little kid of five watching Native American Indians being chased and shot, I actually felt that was probably my first recognition of race.
Really?
And I, on the Indian side, because I thought, well, who are these people? You know, they look more like me than I look like the cowboys. And I kind of wanted to, you know, sympathize with them. And I realized there was something racial going on. I didn't have the vocabulary, but there's definitely something racial going on in a cowboy and Indian film when the, you know, the cowboys are going around, you know, killing everybody. And we're supposed to cheer. So I thought that was strange. So I had sort of secret fantasies of joining the Indians. And then so that was my first ever, I guess, I don't know, first time I saw Westerns, probably 5 years old or something. Anyway, then later on, about 7 years old, I had a conversation with the staff at the institution, and they told me that my father was black, so that, like an official conversation that we had.
Yeah.
And I was asking about him, but it was all very vague, because I kind of got the impression that I was in the children's home because he was black, which meant that the reason he was black is that he hadn't married my mother. And the reason that I was in the institution was my mother wasn't married and I was black. So it was kind of evil, you know, the black bit. And nobody really wanted to talk about him. So it was all just very, very taboo. And I didn't really ask, but I did secretly again want to meet him and find out his side of the story, which I did later on.
When do you think you kind of began to understand it, I guess, if ever?
Eventually, I went to my mother and her new white husband and went to a, you know, very multiracial London city school, and kind of, you know, realised, sort of worked it all out, you know, just with the friends there who weren't institutionalised, who were, you know, London city kids, with all the different cultures. So then, gradually I worked out that these are all the different cultures and all the different stories. And eventually, at 14, I met my father and his father and his whole family. And they explained to me that that if my mother's relationship with his side of the family was originally quite close, and they explained to me that what normally would have happened for mothers and children abandoned by the dads, by the fathers, the baby fathers, which is the culture, is that the women would bring them up. So my mother would have been integrated into my father's family, and I and my sister would have been raised by my father's cousins. And anyway, that sort of casual adoption wasn't possible officially anyway. And my mother and father wouldn't have wanted it. So that's why we ended up in care. But I did find all that out when I was about 14.
Okay. That must have been a lot though. What was it like being a person of colour and in care?
Well, the only kind of suffering I had, I suppose, was that there was no one to look after our, you know what it's like with our hair, right?
Yeah, I was going to ask about that, actually.
But, yeah, so there was nothing doing about the hair. So all my photographs as a kid, my hair is just like some weird kind of hedge. And I just looked, and I was just desperate, you know, the vanity that I had. I wanted to understand my hair, and nobody understood what to do with the hair. So all the you know, black kids and dual heritage kids just had sort of sheer haircuts.
Yeah.
And we found that really, really humiliating, because we didn't have any, everyone else, you know, had a little ribbon. You had a sort of crazy afro with a ribbon, and that was it. All of my childhood, and every time there was a haircut, it was really traumatic. And so, so as soon as I was an adult, I grew my hair long, and it's been long ever since. You know, it's like
what
they told me that
my hair
didn't grow. Well, they said that my kind of hair, they called it my kind of hair, does not grow long. That was all they knew, and it was kind of, well, maybe they knew that it did grow long, but they didn't know what to do with it.
How to do it?
I mean, you know, why should they? So the easiest thing for them to do was just to cut it as best they could. Bless them, you know, no hard feelings.
Yeah. I think I can't remember my age, but I think like year four to about year six, I always just wore a bandana, but just covered my whole head with it. I'd cut it really short. Did you ever have headlights when you were younger?
No.
Oh, well, that's lucky, because obviously no one knew my hair. No one knew how to do it. So we cut it all off, and then I hated it because I looked like a boy. So all my school photos between those ages, I was just wearing a headband. a bandana, sorry, because no one
because that's exactly, because we look very boyish, don't we?
Yeah, exactly.
With short hair, there's nothing, you know, we've got these strong faces and noses and we just look like little boys. So yeah. So a bandana, what colour? Did you have a nice pretty girl?
No, I think I had a blue satin one, like a black and white paisley one.
Oh.
I really look like a pirate. Right. And then the boys at school always used to snatch it off. And my hair would be flat against, it was awful.
Oh yes, that's right. The flat carpet. Oh God, yeah. Humiliation. Yeah. So when did the bandana come off permanently?
So I used to live in the Falkland Islands again, everyone. Yeah. So a lot of people were white. And then this lady from Uganda came and married a farmer. And as soon as we saw her, we were like, she was 25 and me and my sister were like 12 and I don't know, we were very young. But she braided our hair for the first time ever.
Oh, magic.
It was amazing. And yes. Then we went to school and everyone was like, oh my God, your hair's grown 12 inches. Yeah, and we're like, yeah, wonderful. This is my hair.
Wonderful. Yeah. But, God, yeah. It's so important.
It is.
Oh, wow. Thank goodness someone came to rescue you.
I know. And then after that, it was straighteners for ages because we didn't know what to do.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
hair is important. I really do agree that, like,
yeah, it's a huge
when you don't know what to do with it and no one knows how to handle it, it makes you feel very, I don't know. And you just when you're surrounded with these girls who are like curling their hair and straightening it and doing all these fun things, and you're wearing a bandana.
Exactly. It says, "I am neglected." That's the message it says. She's really on one and level, or there's some. Some people don't know what they're doing, or you know, this makes you vulnerable.
Yeah.
Which we don't. You know, everybody's vulnerable, but it's like we're extra vulnerable.
What advice would you give your younger self?
Right, I would say. Right, I've got the list of five things.
Okay.
So, younger self, right? Believe it or not, melancholy is your friend. Right. Keep up your passion for research. It is your strength. The miserable people who are trying to undermine you do not succeed. Enjoy the love of house mother, auntie, Daisy, while it lasts.
Oh.
She retired when I was 10. It was terrifying. Don't worry too much about your hair. because you are right. It is able to grow long.
And you proved yourself.
And then don't neglect the study of your biological parents. They are the specimens of true society. That sounds a bit unfriendly, but I don't mean to be unfriendly. That's it.
Can I ask you about the melancholy one?
I think I was just by nature solitary, and I think for children it's quite a difficult environment. So we had each other to play with, which meant games and football, but we just didn't have any other culture. None. And I didn't really know that until later when I was 13, I joined a youth orchestra, and then I realized just how ignorant I was. Mm. So I think my melancholy just came from just sort of intellectual boredom, really.
Mm. Did you find that you were quite good at making your own fun then, or did it go the other way where you just...
I became obsessed with the wildlife, with pond life. And there was beautiful. I mean, the Bernardo's grounds was, you can imagine, it had a little forest, it had a little farm. And eventually I had, Bernardo's allowed me to have a menagerie. So I had lots of animals with my sibling brother, George. Mm-hmm. And we were breeding fancy pigeons and chickens and pheasants. I mean, we had all that going on. And that sustained me, because otherwise I think I probably would have gone mad.
Mm. Did it make you more independent, do you think?
Yeah, I think it did. I was, as a result, I've really learnt about wildlife and environmentalism, and that's my job. I mean, I'm an environmentalist artist.
Oh, wow.
And in the end, yes, it did affect me, because I was able to understand, the environment. So all my work is about the environment. I'm a site-specific sculptor, if you do know what that, So I make a sculpture about a site in a national park. That's kind of what I've been doing, for about 30 years, and gradually went from making big sculptures to national park permanent public art sculptures. And I think that probably comes from staring at nature. probably as a child.
Yeah. How did you get into art? Environmental artist, did you say?
I was a carpenter, because my father's a carpenter as well.
Okay.
Was a carpenter. And so that was fun for a while. But then, you know, it was just, I just was more creative than that in the end. I mean, not knocking carpentry. I'm just not very good at carpentry, as it turned out. But anyway, so I got, and eventually the work just got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. Anyway, I really, really wanted to meet my father. I needed that side of the story, because I always had my mother's side of the story. I mean, I have to tell you this because it's so weird. That I was with my mother on a bus, because my sister and I went to live with her very briefly when she got married, and they went back into Barnardo's. But I was with her on a bus, and she pointed to a street and said, "Your father lives in that street." And I just carried on looking straight ahead, because I knew the street very well, because my best friend lived in that street. And I went to school the next day and I said, "Oh my God, my father lives in your street." And I understood my father's name as Brasman, which is a cricket name, a cricketer's name. And so my friend and I, the next day at the weekend, went up and down the street knocking on doors saying, does Mr. Brasman live here? And nobody said anything about Mr. Brasman. And then a few months went by and my friend turned up at school with newspapers, and in it was a gift from my father. And she said, "Your father is my mother's friend. He lives next door and his name is Carden." So what had happened is that my father had a really bad car accident, and he'd been stuck at home with his legs in a cardboard box and looking out the window, and he recognized me because we'd met once when I was seven, and he spotted me and he said to his friend, "Who is that girl? I think she's my daughter." So that's how we met, which is kind of weird. And he gave me a key to his house, and I kept it secret. Nobody knew that I was visiting my father on the weekend. And eventually it all came out and it all just blew up, and because of that my mother kind of rejected me all over again, if you like, and put me back in Barnardo's.
Really?
So that was okay. That was okay. Yeah. But it meant that at this point now I had a bigger idea of the picture of my black West Indian side and my mother's side of the story, my father's side of the story. And I gradually got to know my father, and his father was living in the same house, and I met his cousins and all my other cousins who I still know to this day. And what came about is that I was kind of too white, if you like, so there wasn't black enough. So there's that old problem where you're sort of not, you know, you're not black enough, that you're just very strange to them. And I tried to sort of integrate with them, and they're very nice people, of course, and very kind, but we don't really have much in common. So, and then I went to Antigua with my dad, and then everybody called me a white woman when I was there. So, you know, because I was very pale and I didn't have the accent, and everybody knew that my mother was white, and if your mother's white, then you're white. So actually, I can't really be black or white.
Not fair,
So then you just have to sort of muddle along, and then you have to kind of be bigger than that, don't you? You have to see the bigger picture. Instead of kind of, you know, getting depressed and feeling sorry for yourself, you have to kind of go out and say, "Oh, yeah," and research it as what I've said, and try to understand, you know, everyone's side of the story. And I don't, you know, there's no kind of resentment. I don't really sort of resent my mother or my father or anybody really. Once you know the story and you put, you know, you try to understand their perspective, and, you know, which I do really understand their perspective. You know.
Yeah.
Have you chosen your own spiritual family, as it were?
No, nothing like that, really. So my foster carers have been parental figures to me for 7 years now, so that's kind of my chosen family.
Ah, yeah.
But at the same time, I went back to Kenya the first time last year, and I saw my mum again for the first time since I was 8 years old, and then I had all this family that I never knew. And it's so crazy that I just have all this extended family. So for me, it was just like, yeah, maybe I didn't grow up with two parents, but I do now. I have all these people in my life that I wouldn't have had otherwise.
Brilliant. Well, that's the perfect attitude. That's it.
Yeah.
That's perfect. So it's an opportunity in the end. Something
yeah.
goes, you know, sort of goes wrong. And then luckily there's all these people around who just put it right and you have an extended family, which is what norm is, the natural thing anyway, is an extended family. You know, it's much better to have all these people around, all these different people that choose you, you choose them, and then the biological lot are there as well. I mean, it's just, you know, it's the community, that's the village raising a child.
Yeah.
In the end, is what you sort of come around to. So you're actually the most privileged.
Yeah, and blood's just a small part of it. It's not as important as it as everyone would want you to believe it is, that kind of thing.
Blood?
Yeah, like blood relations, not...
Yes!
Yeah.
I know, I made a sculpture, the water was is thinner than blood, was the title.
Oh, nice.
Because I just thought, God, you know, all this bloody blood business. And I mean, it's an institution, the blood thing is an institution, but I don't believe in it.
No. I agree.
So good for you. That's very rare. I don't hardly ever hear anybody say things like that.
But yeah, that's. I think we come from it from a different perspective as well. So I think that helps.
Well, I come from the Bernardo's perspective, where the blood didn't matter. It was all about just, you know, kind people looking after vulnerable kids. End of story.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode. We'll be sharing more of this type of thing throughout Black History Month. So keep your eyes and ears peeled. If you're enjoying these conversations, please think about leaving a rating and a review. It would really help us. For more information on the Oral History Project and to learn more about Julian and Irene, please visit the website at www.bernardos.org.uk/oralhistory. Thank you.